The idea here is to start reaching out to other people, to get this word out to a lot of people about where we are, what we're doing, and what we're aiming for. Now, to say that we're aiming for the sky is an understatement. We're aiming for the sky and beyond. We understand that we might end up 6 foot under the earth, but nonetheless, we're going to give them a hell of a run for their money while we're walking on the earth. And so I have this thing that's been burning inside of me. I make an admission here that I've tried to escape the clutches of the Aboriginal political fight a number of times. I tried to get out of it. I wanted to work as a university, went and worked as a public prosecutor in the district courts here in Sydney. I ended up doing diplomatic work in the UN and various other places. Went and played professional football. When I left Canberra, I bought racehorses and tried to become a big knob and big wig in the racing industry. Made a lot of money, mind you. I was very successful with some horses. And in the middle of all of that, there's this yearning, Murray saying, mate, you got the corporate knowledge and we need to start this fight and keep this fight going. And so somehow you get sucked back into it. And so that's my pathway. So I no longer fight against a destiny, I guess. And I've lost a lot, made a lot of friends. But there's also a lot of sacrifices in this game. And it's a hard game. It's not easy. This is not an easy game. Right? And the worst critics are our own mob. Our own mob say, you know, don't go with that silly bastard. Look at him, he's dreaming all the time. You don't get anywhere, you know. But the thing is, what they don't realise is that what we have, the white fella never gave it to us. What we have, what we gained, we got our guts kicked in, we did a lot of things, and we achieved a lot of things in a very short period of time. Unfortunately, the more educated our people got, the worse things got for us, believe it or not. Because as our people, our young ones, got educated, the government were very quick and they knew exactly what they were doing. As they got educated and they were second year into their university degrees, governments came along and offered them, what do they call them, indentureships and cadetships. And so they took them into government bodies and put them into different official sort of state institutions in Canberra. And it was the Commonwealth that actually got them out. None of those young persons that I know who went through during the 70s and 80s who got degrees never ever got back home to their communities after they got their degrees. They never got back there. And the reason they didn't get back there is because they get in there with these cadetships and then they promise them a permanent job at the end of the day. And then when the communities wanted them to go home, the Aboriginal organisations were restricted to being able to pay a CEO or a manager the minimum $32,000 to $38,000 maximum in terms of salary. Now, you've got someone who's done, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 6 years university studies or maybe 8 years, and then all of a sudden they know that they can, with their degrees, they can go and get a job for at least $60,000, $70,000 to $100,000 starting point. So not many of the young ones wanted to go home. And so we ended up with this brain drain out of our communities. And when the young ones got up there in there, they then started telling them that we can make changes from within. And, of course, the best story I heard was over the weekend from a man called Kerry Blackman at Bundaberg. Fred and I had just come back from Bundaberg over the weekend where we participated in a thing called a cultural immersion up at Bundaberg, and there was about 200 blackfellas from central Queensland and around that area. They don't advertise it too widely because there are too many blackfellas to feed. They say that when you advertise a free feed in Queensland, you'll have everybody. So that's that mob there. But I said to him, you know, try and offer a free feed in New South Wales out west there, mate. You know, you just have whole populations coming. And so they were talking about restricting the numbers so that they could feed them. And the thing that I'm beginning to find is what Kerry Blackman said who was the organiser and the manager of this organisation called Gadarjal Corporation, what I found was that this fella was saying he wants to get people, he wants to politicise the people in the grassroots communities. He wants to get them active. He wants this information to get out amongst the people. And he really wants them to take control of their own issues and their own affairs at the grassroots. And, of course, that's what this Aboriginal sovereignty movement is about, understanding what this is and trying to develop a grassroots movement where the people own the movement. It's not imposed upon them. And so I find now that we have an opportunity because of what's going on in those communities. The communities are becoming much more aware. People are starting to ask questions. People are starting to look around. People are starting to follow the Facebook pages and you're starting to get people to understand. There's more people turning up as we get around to some of those community meetings. And you're seeing new faces, and that's great. And not only that, you're also starting to see younger ones who are starting to turn up at these meetings. And the reason we want to get out into those communities is because, you see, it's absolutely useless for us to be in a city and start a movement. Yeah? Because after all, the land rights movement started by the Gurindjis walking off their country and walking and just squatting on their country and not moving and saying, to hell with you, this is our own home. We went there. And then this university, Sydney University, is the one where the old Abscol movement, with the Aboriginal, there was a thing called Abscol, which was an Aboriginal scholarship to this university, which Charles Perkins went through this university on, and then there were other Aboriginal people. And this university student union is the one that actually made a lot of things happen, and they got the students involved and got the students engaged in supporting Aboriginal land rights. In fact, 3,000 to 5,000 Sydney University students, plus a few, but more so this university, were the ones who marched on that street down there with us and fought the police, and they walked, and we had massive numbers. All you have to do is go back and have a look at some of the photographs. If you're engaged in that as a young person then, and you're now one of them grey nomads, go back and have a look at your files, and you'll see some fantastic photographs of large numbers of students marching on the street for land rights. Now, I accepted the invitation to come here tonight to talk about the sovereignty movement because when we put the Aboriginal Embassy up, which culminated from all of those demonstrations, there were two placards there, two major political statements that were made by us. One was land rights now or else. The second one was sovereignty never ceded. And so I consider that we've been very successful in the land rights campaign. And we got to the point where the courts now in this country, and I'll talk about that in a minute, are now trying to suppress the rights that we gained through the legal process and now through the legislative process in terms of Aboriginal rights for land. Our rights and property rights are now recognised in law in this country. So the next step that went sad, and we can talk about native title all we want, but you know it went sad, and you know we're still trying to work out how we're going to fix that one up. But the next one is sovereignty. Now in Mabo, when you look at Mabo, there's some interesting facets of that judgment about Aboriginal rights, and in those Aboriginal rights statements within Mabo, that I guess. Without saying that they recognise Aboriginal sovereignty, they avoided it like the plague. They really did. They had to weave their way around in making a judgment without actually saying that Aboriginal people's sovereignty existed. The first thing that I think the most notable aspect of that case on the question of sovereignty is that sovereignty is not justiciable within the domestic courts, within the municipal courts. Okay. Now, that's an important issue, the fact that we can't contest sovereignty. And so what the courts have said is that we can't contest British sovereignty. We can't contest or challenge Australian sovereignty. I agree with them because their courts are not going to listen to that. And the reason their courts are not going to listen to that is because it's that sovereign state that create the court's existence and give the courts their validity. Yeah? And so the courts are then courts who administer the laws created by that state and by those who are in power. And so they can only make judgments about what legislative and laws that have been created, legislation have been created, and the evolution of the laws that they've created as a result of the common law process that came from England. Now, so when it comes to us asserting sovereignty, then that's, it's crazy. We're just not going to get past first post. But one thing that has been achieved, and it surprises me, and that is that I've been fighting now two Shire councils, yeah, and Fred has been fighting one of them with me. And so I've taken them. We went to the lower court. I got thrown out on a technicality because I was like a black fellow, all the way turning up the day after I was supposed to be at the court. And so the second time they refused to allow my application come back in. They just threw me out and said, "You know, you missed the first one. You missed another one." And I even tried to say that there were other mitigating circumstances, like starving animals who were going to feed them and all that sort of thing, and we're in the middle of a drought. And, anyway, that didn't go down too well, and it didn't count, and so he threw it out. Never got to the point where we got into any arguments or setting down any processes about the court process itself. Now, that's in the magistrate's court, so I never got past first post. Anyway, and Fred did a bit better. At least he got a hearing. He'll talk about that later. But what I did, I then said to the court, I went and I raised myself $10,000 personal out of our pockets, and we paid $10,000. Like, if you want justice, you've got to pay through the nose for it, yeah? There is no such thing as justice unless you've got a lot of money. If you haven't got money, you get no justice. And that's the truth. So to get into that Supreme Court to try and go after that decision down there and to have my matters heard, I had to pay $10,000 to get into the court. That's just to get in there. And then all the questions that I put up, they have to go up by notices of motion. And when you put up a question by notice of motion in the Supreme Court, you've got to pay $185 per notice of motion, per question. So every time I want to raise a question, I have to pay that money and do it properly on the proper form, otherwise they throw it out. Right, so anyway, so I've managed to do that. Now they're trying to argue with the technicality. You see, normally you would get sent to a registrar. The registrar would then set up case management of the case and say, okay, on this date you will file all your arguments. On this date the opposition will then respond to that. And then you've got it. Then on this date we have everything together and we go to trial. We go to battle. Okay? I put that in January this year, February this year. I haven't got past first bloody post. We're still running around trying to get a date because we're running around on all these notices of motion. And so I did basically the same in Queensland. In Queensland, got to the magistrates. At least I got a hearing in the magistrate down there, but they threw it out and said, no, you've got no leg to stand on. There's no merit to your arguments. Then secondly, then I appeal that one. That one only up there only cost me $7,000 to get into the Supreme Court. Right? And then so we got into the Supreme Court in Queensland. Now, when I argued that case, I before coming here, I read over that judgment again. And you see, in Queensland, I subpoenaed the records of the state government. Because, you see, when you read Mabo says that the way in which you acquire land when you first come to it, right, you acquire it by a declaration of war, right? And then at the end of that war, you then enter into a surrender document, it becomes a treaty, and then you exchange arrangements and you organise for the new society. They give you money in order for you to build yourself up to become on par with that society and help you start getting on your feet to become part of that society. And then secondly, they also talk about the laws that you know. Yeah, that's laws that are treated, that are very important to you. So then you negotiate how you join those two laws together. This is after a war. And so you go through these treaty negotiations, and so we give some things up, they give some things up, and then we come together and we form a union through the treaty process at the end of that war. And then that becomes a total surrender of us, and we then become part of the total power bloc. The other way that Mabo said that happens is that we voluntary cede. That is, we sign a document saying, there you are, you follow the boss now, we'll come under all your law, we become part of your society, and these are the conditions that we want. Yeah? Even in a cession document, there is an arrangement whereby you get a negotiated outcome, and we end up with a satisfactory, an amicable approach to our union and how we get together. That didn't happen. Right. And so the third way is the country's terra nullius. No one there, uninhabited, yeah? Desolate, uncultivated. Now, it's the last word there that I used, which is what Mabo did to in Mabo. And Ellie brought it to my attention because I've been sort of looking for other things, and then Ellie sort of points out that there's a simple little statement in there in that judgment. Because she keeps saying Mabo, knocking out terra nullius, actually expanded the concept of terra nullius. I think, how do you do that? He just threw it out. And you're telling me that they've expanded? So I went back and looked at Mabo again. And this time, Ellie pointed me to where it said. And she's absolutely right. What the court's done is that they said, okay, looking at all the history, we did the wrong thing to Aboriginal people. Totally. On this side here then, what they said was that the Aboriginal people, we can't continue to go through and say that these people were cannibals, that they had no society and no structure, and that they were wandering around aimlessly on this country, lost because they got cut off from the rest of the world after the ice melted and there's no escape out of the country. And no one could get down here and save our poor little souls and help us organise ourselves into a society with some sort of civil order. And so Mabo said, that's rubbish. Yeah. There is an organised society. There was an organised society. But they couldn't say that we were sovereign nations. Right? Now, so when they did that, they ignored the sovereignty. They pushed the sovereignty thing aside. And then they then go on to talking about what is the rights of the Aboriginal people? What rights remain in the land in Australia, given that the British arrived here and asserted sovereignty? And so when the British came here and asserted sovereignty, they say that they gained an absolute radical title. You see, but other court cases since have raised another little word in front of the word radical title. And the word that's missing off the radical title of the Crown is beneficial. That's the word that's missing from the Crown's right to the land. They did not gain a beneficial title to this country. They did not gain. Now, what does that mean? Well, a beneficial radical title means that they have total control over it, essentially. And I thought, now how do you assert then, without saying that you have a beneficial title, and the courts don't say it, how did we lose in Mabo? How did we lose that argument? And the way in which we lost it is that Mabo said that Aboriginal proprietary rights in land, that is, our real estate, our rights in that land, comes from our law, not from English law. And so that right and those laws survived British sovereignty. That's what Mabo says. Our laws survived British sovereignty. But we lost the title to the land, because the Crown now owns it. And that's the confusing part here. And so what makes that even harder to understand is Mabo also said that Aboriginal title, that is our proprietary interest under our law and custom, burdens Crown title.